All right, Fitness Retention Podcast. We have got something different for you today. Today we have Amy Bond, the CEO and founder of San Francisco Pole and Dance and Oakland Pole and Dance. And I know what you're thinking. A pole dancing studio is not a gym. But you're wrong. Amy, in this episode, taught me, I think, more than almost any other episode. Amy's background is as a lawyer and as a consultant, and she runs a badass business and actually just opened up her second business. There are so many lessons in this podcast and so many just tips that I would never think to do or even think about. So if you are looking for something new, something spicy to add into either your management or your operations, this is a fantastic podcast for you. As always, if you would like to be on the show or if you would like to work together, shoot me an email at agymotion@gmail.com. That's agymotion@gmail.com, and we will figure out how to make that happen. All right, here's Amy Bond of San Francisco and Oakland Pole and Dance. All right, the Fitness Retention Podcast would like to welcome Amy Bond of San Francisco Pole and Dance Studio. Amy, what's up?
How you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
Good, good. Over in the Bay Area, we have a flash flood warning today, so that should be fun.
We do?
Yeah.
Oh. All right. Well, ignorance is bliss.
Yes. Crossing fingers. It's all pretend.
Amy, for the people and the listeners of the show who may not know you, can you give a brief introduction about how you came to own San Francisco Pole and Dance Studio and kind of where you're at now?
Yeah, so my name is Amy Bond. I've lived in the San Francisco Bay Area for almost 6 years. My husband and I met in Portland while he was living in LA. I moved in with him in LA, and then he followed me to law school in Boston, where we went for 3 years. And we thought we were going to stay on the East Coast after law school, but over the course of the 3 years of very cold winters in Boston, we realized that we are California people through and through, and we jumped on what was actually the first flight back to San Francisco after my graduation, and we've been very happily living in the Bay Area ever since, so that's almost 6 years now. Wow. As a new attorney, obviously, I spent a very sad and depressing summer studying for the California bar exam, passed, and then worked in a legal capacity and operations capacity at startups for about 4 years before I decided to open San Francisco Pole and Dance. And I did both for a while. I worked in tech, you know, by day and then ran my business by night for a good 6 months, which was super stressful and tiring. And then I gave up the tech gig and started running my business full-time after I'd been doing it on the side for about 6 months. And I haven't really looked back. So that's me in a nutshell.
How long ago was that? How long ago did you make the switch from doing both to running just your own business?
Yeah, so I did an asset purchase agreement, drafted myself so that I knew what protection I was getting, in order to buy the assets of a failing pole dance studio that existed before San Francisco Pole and Dance. And I bought that in, which is basically taking over a lease, in May of 2016. And then I started doing San Francisco Pole and Dance full time in November of 2016.
Okay.
So just a couple of years ago.
So we're at like 2.5 years.
Yeah.
And what has happened from the day you took over the lease and until now?
Yeah. So the basically, actual.
How great are you doing?
Yeah. Well, we're doing really awesome, actually. Like, I really believe that pole dancing is in a nascent phase. It's been around as a sport for about 10 years. And I've seen it grow from the time I started law school. I took my first pole dance class the same day that I took my first law school class. Hmm. And then I fell in love both with the law and with pole dancing simultaneously. And, you know, I just wanted more of both. I wanted to, you know, read as many law books as I could and do as many moot court competitions as I could. And I wanted to do as many pro bono cases as I could while I had the guidance of a mentor in law school. And I also wanted to take as many pole dance classes and compete in as many competitions for pole as I could too. So I was balancing, you know, two very different worlds. And still I do still practice law. I have 5 startups who are legal clients who I consult with. Mm-hmm. And so I do that mainly on the weekends. And I like to call law my side hustle because I really do it on the side and running my business, San Francisco Pole and Dance, and now my second business, Oakland Pole and Dance, mm-hmm. is what I spend the majority of my time doing. And it's the thing I'm most passionate about.
When did you open up Oakland?
Just 3 months ago, so November of 2018. And we're, you know, I feel like it's my new baby girl.
What does retention mean to you, Amy?
Yeah, I think, so the studio that I took over had retention, right? And if you looked at the numbers, it had really good retention. Mm-hmm. Because it was the only option in the San Francisco city proper. It was the only place that people could actually go to take a pole dancing class that was specific to more of a tricks-based style. There's another studio, shout out to Entangle and Sway, that's been out in the San Francisco city proper for, I think, over 7 years now. Mm-hmm. But they do more of like a sexy style. And the studio that I took over was more of a fitness-based style of pole dancing.
Okay.
And so people who wanted that style of pole dancing really only had that place to go to. Mm-hmm. Even though the studio was run poorly and customers were not treated well, it had good retention, I guess. Mm. But I wouldn't call that like the gold standard because they had a monopoly on the pole dance, you know, industry. And if you wanted to pole dance around other people and not just in your bedroom at home, you had to go to that studio. Huh. When I think of retention, I really think of, you know, do people have other options and they're choosing my studio over the other options and not just because it's the only thing that exists? Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important way of, so I'm going to toot my own horn and say, I think it's a smart way of thinking about it because if there's not a competitor now, there probably will be soon if you're not running your studio well, right? Mm-hmm. So when I think of retention, I really think of, am I providing a service that people fall in love with when they come to my studio? And I think people fall in love with things that make them feel good about themselves, mm-hmm. and that offer a sense of community. And the community aspect is the thing that I really took a bet on when I opened my first studio. I wanted to build a place that felt like coming home, that felt like you were surrounded by your friends, where you felt like people were cheering for you as you embarked on a journey of doing this thing that was really vulnerable. I mean, it's a hard sell to ask people to take most of their clothes off, strip down to a bikini in front of full-length mirrors and a bunch of strangers you don't know, and try something you're probably going to be pretty terrible at the beginning. So, you know, I'm already asking a lot of my clients, and I want to build a really soft and community-driven space so that people feel comfortable and safe and like it's a place to come back to. Mm. And so that's really how I think of retention. Are you happy and do you feel safe and surrounded by a community in my space? That's like the real standard for me.
Hmm. I think that the element of, like, a lot of people use the word community. Mm-hmm. But I think the element of safe is really interesting. And like whether or not you have most of your clothes on or off, I think that element of feeling safe is just an interesting way to put it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I think for women, especially, we live in this world, you know, it's like that, not for women, especially for everybody, because I have a lot of male students who feel this way too. And people who are non-gender identifying students, who feel like, you know, how do I own my sexuality in this world? How do I feel comfortable with my own body and in my own body? And pole is a little bit different from other forms of exercise in that a lot of the more sexy style of dancing. You're, you know, throwing your hair, you're, you know, rubbing your hands down your body. It's a very sensual type of movement. Mm-hmm. And some people hate that part about it. And so they trend to just tricks and they don't do any sexy style. Mm-hmm. But honestly, the people who stick around in their, you know, pole journeys or their pole careers, they seem to mostly come back to that style of movement because it's very empowering. And I get at least one email a day from somebody who's told me that pole dance has changed their life because they feel safe in their body and they feel proud of their body in a way that they don't in the rest of the world. I've fired clients and asked them not to come back to my studio because that sense of safety and protection is really important to me. And if it's compromised, then it ruins the community aspect for everyone else.
So when someone walks through your doors, do you, I mean, I'm assuming there's like a level of questioning and understanding. Do you find that most people would be good clients for you or would be good customers, or what's the mix of like good versus not good coming in? And I'm using good as like a, in quotations here.
Sure. I mean, I've only fired a few customers. My very high standard is don't be a creep. Okay. And you know, if you make a suggestive comment to somebody you're dancing with and that person feels unsafe and they tell me about it and okay. I've told you not to do that and then it happens again, then I'm going to ask you not to come back.
Okay.
You know, I had one client who stalked one of my instructors online and then stalked me online and I had to ask them not to come back. And, you know, sometimes that leads to a bad Yelp review, but the protection of the studio and the space is like a sacred space for people to feel good about themselves is to me the key and like the glue that holds the rest of it together.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't believe that led to a bad Yelp review, but I guess stalking someone, you probably have questionable intentions anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, so can we talk a little bit about like when you took over the business, can mm-hmm. we talk a little bit about some of the numbers? You and I had talked offline a little bit about it before.
Yeah, I'm happy to tell you exactly how much I made and how much I, you know, that's fine.
Let's do it.
No, honestly, like I wish more people did this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So like when you took over the business, I think maybe you mentioned there were like X amount of bookings per week or per month. And now there are, I don't know, you tell me.
So in May 2016, I had 122 students. So students who were booking original bookings. So that might actually be less students because some students book multiple sessions.
Uh-huh.
And there were no membership options. Every class you had to pay for individually. Huh. And so I changed the pricing structure quite a bit to be more membership focused. So at San Francisco Pole and Dance, our first actual month was June of 2016.
Okay.
So the previous month had had 122 bookings. When I took over, we instantly had six people sign up for membership. So to me, the memberships is a really important aspect of the business because those are the people who know the space in and out. Mm-hmm. And they can be my champions for me when I'm not there or when I'm teaching. I can't tell you how many people will be standing in, you know, the dressing room of the studio. And then that's when they start talking to the people next to them. Oh, hey, you know, do you come here? Oh, yeah, I take, you know, I'm actually a member. I take class every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Here's the classes I like. And then those conversations get started. And that, you know, community starts to get built without me having to be the one to be like, oh, here's our schedule, which is a little less personal anyway. And so having the members, to me, that was like the metric that I was most curious about. And I even wrote a blog post about this. After 1 year, that six members had gone up to 17 members, which isn't anything really to write home about. Like, okay, 17 members and you have, you know, at that point we had close to 600 people walking through our doors every day. Mm-hmm. after 1 year. So great, we had 6x increase in bookings, which was great for the bottom line. Mm-hmm. But we only had 17 members, and at the 1 year mark I had written a blog post about like the things I learned, and my learning, which I now think is incorrect, was that memberships just don't work at that high of a price point if you're in, not an all-inclusive gym. Mm-hmm. So our memberships at the time were $300 a month. Now they're $360 a month. And, you know, as we started adding more classes and more instructors and more styles, mm-hmm. and we moved into a bigger space where we could offer aerial silks, aerial lyra, every day a flexibility class, that's when I really started to see my numbers, my membership numbers go up. Today, right now, with over 2,200 people walking through our doors every single month, you know, just 2.5 years later, that's what, a 22x increase?
That's crazy.
52% of our students are members.
Damn.
Now, that's an insane number. I don't know anyone else in the fitness industry who don't have showers in their facilities, are not in Equinox, who can say they have 52% memberships. And I think that really speaks to the community.
Yeah, I mean, and like you bring up something like showers, and maybe to someone who is not in the fitness industry, I'll be like, that's not that big of a deal.
Oh, no, that matters.
But that's a huge, I mean, that's like going to a restaurant and being like, well, we don't serve alcohol.
Right.
Like that's a huge draw for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So you went from 122 bookings in a month from the previous month when you took over to now. 2,200.
Yeah, and that number keeps increasing. So we had over 10x increase the first year. Then we had closer to a 5x increase over that 10x the next year. And now 2,200 people in January. We're geared to actually beat that with February, which February numbers are never better than January. Yeah. But for some reason, they are at both of my studios. So, you know, it just keeps going up. And I really think it's a testament both to the community we've built and also the fact that pole dancing in general is starting to be more considered like a socially acceptable thing, which is super annoying. Like when I started pole dancing, I didn't tell anyone because I didn't want people to be like that fucking slut. But, oh, sorry. You know, and then it became okay after I started calling it fitness. Then everyone was like, oh, well, it's just a fitness class. Oh, okay, it's fine. But then I too really came back around to the heels work. And now, you know, the majority of my time when I spend training, I'm really working in heels and doing a style of pole dancing that's called Russian Exotic, which is toe box work, low flow work, very dynamic gymnastics-y style of pole dancing. And I love it. And it's very slutty, but for whatever reason, let's think Cardi B maybe or Rihanna, you know, it's starting to be okay to do those types of movements now.
I want to go back to something you said. You said for some reason it keeps. Mm-hmm.
For what? Oh, sorry.
It's all good. You said for some reason it keeps growing, but
yeah.
You and I probably both know that for some reason there are a number of reasons behind that, right? Like it's not just coincidence that it's grown, let's say like 25x in 2 years.
Yeah.
So aside from the community, what do you think are the things that like really are driving your growth? Not only the growth, but the ability to keep people there, because if you grow in acquisition, but people go out the back door, you're not really growing.
Yeah, totally. So I do think the community piece is the most important aspect.
For
we
sure.
also have included in the unlimited membership, we give our students a key fob to the space and they're allowed to come in and train at any time. Hmm. So when we first, our first year in operation, there was a regional competition in 2017. Mm-hmm. And so that was the first regional competition after we'd opened, which was February of 2017. I think we had 12 competitors competing at Golden Gate 2017, myself included. 2018, we had like 25, which was double that first year's number, myself included. And that seemed like, you know, at that point I was like, there's no way we can possibly have more competitors than this. This is such a crazy number. Also, pole dance competitions seem like such a niche thing. It's certainly not a very high percentage of actual people who go to pole dancing classes commit to what's basically a 3-month grueling journey of, you know, a really dedicated practice to creating an artistic 3-minute routine that's character driven and choreographed. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of work. It takes about 3 months of dedicated work. So this past year, imagine my shock when we had 39 competitors from San Francisco Pole and Dance compete at the regional competition, which was last week. And then Oakland Pole and Dance, which wasn't even on like the drop down of the Golden Gate like registration form, because we opened in November and registration ended in November, we managed to still get 5 students from Oakland Pole and Dance compete in February. So I think the rise of the competition student, like it's a very specific demographic to me, is also a really interesting phenomenon, and maybe the competition fuels that type of student. But coming back to your question, why did it grow that much? I think there's so many reasons, so many social and cultural reasons that, you know, about women embracing their sexuality and saying, you know, F you to societal norms, to also, we like are very unapologetically feminist in the way that we run our pole dance studio. It's not just for women. It's not just for people who identify as women. It's for everybody. And it's not just for a certain body type. It's for all body types. And there are so many different styles. And I think too, the way that we've, you know, done the space is it very much looks like a blank canvas. Mm-hmm. So it's white and gray and black color palette. There's not very much stuff in it. So you can kind of make it whatever you want it to be for yourself. And some people want to do that sexy style of choreography. And some people want to do gymnastics, acrobatics in heels, mm-hmm. and do that Russian exotic style. And some people only want to do tricks. And some people don't want to pole dance at all. They want to do aerial silks or aerial lyra or flexibility. And we've created the space in a way where it can be anything for whatever type of aerial you decide to do, mm-hmm. and thrive in. And so I think those are a couple of things that help it as well.
How much of the evolution of your business is based on like instinct? So your instinct, and how much of it is like based on what you're seeing in the market or in other markets?
Yeah, so that's actually a really funny question, and I'm gonna say a really maybe surprising answer, which is I really am building the thing that I want. And so, you know, when I think of what I want out of a pole dance studio, it's what I built at San Francisco, and it's also what I've built at Oakland. And, you know, I have a couple of gripes at each. The floors at San Francisco are too hard, but, you know, it costs $80,000 to build sprung dance floors. So that is what it is. And I know intimately the sport and what I've been to probably 100 studios across the world. I lived in Singapore for a while where pole dancing is very big. I traveled around Southeast Asia where pole dancing is really big. Been to studios like all across Europe and the United States. So I've been to a lot of studios and have kind of gotten a feel for what works other places and what doesn't work, which also really matters. And so I know the industry really well as a competitor, as a student, as an instructor, as a traveling instructor. And I think that really helps guide my instinct. So I wouldn't say I'm just like throwing darts at a wall. I really, you know the industry really well. And I think spending 5 years as an instructor before I opened the studio was that necessary like research incubation time where I was still just like trying to learn as much as I could.
Yeah, I think it sounds like it's instinct, but it's informed.
Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah. Like you said, you've been to 100 or at least 100 around the world. Mm-hmm. You're gonna see things there that you're like, wow, I wanna steal that, or there's no way I'm gonna do that. So.
And now when I go to pole dance studios, I do the same thing. Every yep. time I go to a new space, oh, what are they doing here? How do they do their, you know, lockers? Mm-hmm. You know, lockers matter. How do they do their branded gear? Oh, how did you get that shimmer on that logo that you put on that sweatshirt? Oh, can I have the name of the person who did that sweatshirt? You know, or like, I recently went to a studio in Portland called the Aerospace, and they have on their doors this big cork board and a little Polaroid camera, and you take a you can take a picture of yourself and answer three questions on the bottom of the Polaroid that say your name, your favorite poll trick, and your favorite food. Uh-huh. And I love stuff like that because it's so community building and you see a lot of people around the studio, but maybe you don't know their names, so you can go look at the board and I'm taking stuff from other places all the time and am so inspired by other studios all the time.
So you have a Polaroid camera like kind of mounted and then mm-hmm. takes a picture and then you post it up on a tack board?
And you use a Sharpie to write like your name and a two fun facts. And then you put it on a little cork board.
I like that a lot.
Yeah, it's super cute. And like anybody could use that.
Yeah, and I mean, like, that's one of those things that is, what, maybe $10, $20 a month for you as a business owner?
Done.
And if you facilitate or, like, make an introduction between someone new and someone who's been there a long time, like, mm-hmm. if you do one of those a month, that's worth $20.
Totally.
And it's and that, I, like,
yeah. Also, like, there's a long lifespan of our customers' lifetime value. I just how Facebook does those memories?
Yeah.
And it will tell you, like, 5 years ago, da-da-da. Yeah. So I got one of those Facebook memories that said 5 years ago, and it had a picture of my very first poll series that I'd taught 5 years ago in San Francisco. And all five of the women who are in that picture, who are my students, are still people I see every week because they still come to the studio and they still pole dance. And it's not just like a fad thing. Like, and all of them have competed at least once in at least one competition. Huh. And so I remember thinking, wow, that lifetime customer value is much longer than I think I would have estimated if I was asked to.
Have you calculated that?
Yeah, I mean, I make a gross estimate, but also we're only 2.5 years old at San Francisco. So what is considered the lifetime value right now doesn't capture like the full, like if students are still pole dancing after 5 years, 2.5 years is going to capture just 2.5 years. I think I just need more time to get better data than what I would rely on now.
Do you see that the lifetime value generally is increasing as your gym ages?
Yes.
Okay. That's cool. That's a good growth sign.
Yeah.
So what, when you look at like, you just opened your second location. Mm-hmm. When you look 5 years down the line, if you look that far, what are you looking at? Because it seems like you're building something that's very personal to you. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes things that are really personal are harder to scale or like blow out to like 10 or 20 or however many locations. So how do you manage that like integrity of your vision with growth?
Yeah, it's a really hard question to answer. And I think the first answer is I have no idea. And I'm learning as I go. So I will say that opening the second studio was much harder than I thought it would be. And part of the reason is because I opened San Francisco and it was just me and I had four instructors who each taught two classes a night and really cheap rent in the original space that I was in. And so my overhead was super low. I think my rent in like the first space I was in was 1200 square feet and it's on the second floor in kind of a rough part of town on Folsom and 8th. To put it lightly. Our rent there was like less than $5,000 a month. Wow. And then my payroll, that was back when I was paying people as independent contractors, which I don't recommend, especially after Dynamex. Mm-hmm. But that cost was like less than $4,000 a month as mm-hmm. well. And I was just teaching all the rest of the classes. And my credit card bill, was basically alcohol for cleaning off the poles was like my biggest expense. Uh-huh. So I was really like DIYing it and my costs were less than $10,000 a month to open that studio. And so I was able to get to profitability really quickly with such low costs, but I was working like 80 hours a week plus all the other stuff I was doing. And so when I opened Oakland, I am still teaching at San Francisco and still running that business, though I have hired a general manager and front desk managers and more staff. But, you know, anybody who has 40 employees knows that, like, that requires a significant amount of your time. Yeah. So I couldn't just do the same thing at Oakland and say, okay, I'm going to work 80 hours a week at this, because I'm already working at least 40 hours. You know, there's not any more hours.
Yeah.
So I opened Oakland, and I immediately hired a general manager. So Carrie, mm-hmm. who has been an instructor for me at San Francisco for quite some time, I started another business with her a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. I hired her as my general manager to run more of, like, you know, I think of it as like a COO and a CEO, and she's more of the COO of Oakland Pole and Dance. Mm-hmm. And I thought, great, Carrie will do all of that. We'll have front desk managers. We'll have a built out staff from the very beginning. So we have lots of help. Mm-hmm. And that ends up being very expensive. And so our monthly burn rate at Oakland is closer to $26,000 a month, uh-huh. which, you know, we're not at profitability yet. And even though we're growing actually faster than San Francisco grew, mm-hmm. we're only 3 months into our business. And so I am using San Francisco Pole and Dance as a piggy bank for Oakland Pole and Dance's first 12 months of business. And I think that's, you know, if my projections are correct and we keep growing at the rate we'll be growing, it will be at least another 6 months before we get to profitability. And so I just planned for it to be 12 months. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, taking that 10K or whatever it is every month from San Francisco and putting it directly into Oakland and know I'm going to lose the money is really stressful. Like, because I spent so much time working for free to build San Francisco. And then finally I got to a place where I'm like feeling great. And then I turn around and put all of it on into Oakland. And, you know, I'm like, I hope it works. And all yeah. the signs are pointing in the direction that it's going to work. But I'm back to that feeling of like, what if everybody stops coming tomorrow? What if, you know, now I'm not only, you know, now I'm not only disappointing myself, but I'm also disappointing a huge staff. And so there's a lot of additional, like emotional pressure that I didn't expect. Yeah. And I think that's something that not a lot of people talk about, but I do also, you know, I do, as a legal advisor in operations capacity, consult with 5 startups. And I think startups and small businesses are not that different in the sense that they're really scary for founders. Mm-hmm. And I hear this from my startup, the CEOs who I work for in a legal capacity. I hear this kind of thing from them all the time, yeah. where it's, but what if I fail and I lose other people's money? Yeah. And so I think that's a very real, a very common sense to have. And I'm just kind of trying to remind myself that I'm not alone with it.
Yeah. I mean, like, first off, kudos. It's, I'm sure, very hard to, I mean, not hard to bet on yourself, but to like bet everything on yourself and then do it again.
Yeah.
That's, you know, like, that's gotta be very challenging.
I mean, what kind of asshole am I, right? Like, I'm like, oh, I finally got to a place where I feel safe. You know what? I'm going to roll that dice again. Like, this is boring.
You know? It depends on what's on the line. I mean, you might be able to build like a quote unquote, like you mentioned earlier, a monopoly on pole dancing in the Bay Area. And then yeah. it might be worth it.
Well, I mean, my plan, if Oakland goes well, and I'm not thinking about anything before Oakland reaches profitability, like I really just want to get it there first, is okay, well, what does the San Jose market look like? Okay, what does the, you know, Sunnyvale market look like? Mm-hmm. And then Portland, Oregon is, I just am obsessed with that city. So I think that would be an amazing space to go. And by the way, if you look at real estate outside of the Bay Area, you have sticker shock at how low everything is.
Yeah.
You know, it's like actually kind of awesome when you've been anchored so high in your head about what a rent should be and you start looking outside of this city, it ends up being really inexpensive to do the same thing somewhere else. Hmm. And what's interesting about Portland and Seattle markets is that both of those cities the cost of living is about the same, but the rent is much less expensive. So people are used to paying the same amount for a pole class in Portland, Seattle, as they are in San Francisco, Oakland. But, you know, I'm looking, I've talked to a real estate agent in Portland, and the rents are, you know, closer to $4,000 a month, whereas my Oakland rent, you know, for a 2,500 square foot space in Oakland, I'm paying $9,000 a month.
Damn.
So.
Jeez. Well, and I feel like Portland is indie enough kind of to be like, yeah, I'll do pole dancing five times a week. Like,
oh yeah.
Like, I feel like there's a pole dancing there. All right. So let's gravitate towards some of the meaty questions real quick. First question, what is something that every fitness business can do starting tomorrow to have the long-term effect of making more money?
Yeah, so one thing that I do at Oakland with Carrie, who's my general manager, is every Wednesday we have a monthly meeting, and we generate a report where we see everybody who's a new student, mm-hmm. and we call them and we say, how was it? You know, we're a brand new business and we're still building, and we want to know how we can do better to make sure your experience is as awesome as possible. How can we do better for you? And we get so high off of those phone calls. And if they don't answer the phone, which 70% of the time they won't, we text them. And then the conversation is just as fruitful. Because people seem to text a lot more than they want to talk on the phone.
Yeah.
So we'll get like novellas back with the answer to that question. And we get really close, up and close and personal pulse on what our students think about our studio and where maybe the experience wasn't awesome and where we can be training our staff that to go that extra mile. And so I think that makes a really big difference. It also makes people feel like they're part of the thing that you're building.
Yeah.
The other thing that we do is we ask for Yelp previews at the end of every class. And so I think Yelp is the scum of the earth. I hate their business model. I think that the way that they have set their algorithms is really unethical. And there's probably a class action lawsuit brewing somewhere.
Yeah.
But people, especially in the Bay Area, do you know 70% of Yelp's users are in the San Francisco Bay Area? So if you have a fitness business in the San Francisco Bay Area, you better be paying attention to Yelp.
Damn.
And so asking for the Yelp review and saying why it matters, I won't just say, oh, and by the way, can you leave me a Yelp review? I'll say, you know what? I'm a small business owner. We've only been here in this market for 3 months. It would mean the world to me if you could leave us a Yelp review. And then I have one of my assistants. I have a virtual assistant. I use a service called Red Butler, and they're awesome. They do remote virtual assistants based out of the United States, mm-hmm. Which for me, that's been the most successful virtual assistant to hire, because most of the communication is through email, and so it requires a stronghold on English grammar. Mm-hmm. I'll have my assistant follow up with each one of those new students and say, here's the link to our Yelp page. If you could take 2 minutes to leave us Yelp review, that would be awesome.
I think both of those things are clutch. I think the calling people after like an initial period of membership is really,
yeah.
I mean, like, here's the thing is you have people that are already in your business,
mm-hmm.
and they're telling you how you can craft your business to keep them longer.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know why.
People want to tell you what they think. They just need an invitation, and then they will go on and on. And I am all ears for that, because that is gold.
And the cost of that is so low. Yeah. Like, it's a phone call.
Yep.
You know, like, I just don't know. Well, I don't know why more companies, like, obviously, if you have 20,000 members in your facility, you can't call 2,000 or 1,000 new members every month. Or you could, but it would be tough.
Yeah.
But calling 10 of them, like, that's something.
Yeah. You know, my husband is an executive at Microsoft, and one thing that people on his team do who are product managers is they spend one day a month just talking to customers. They just go in and they talk to customers. So this isn't even like a small business solution. Like everybody who can afford it is doing it. And I think even big companies, you know, Microsoft's one of the biggest companies in the world, and they have people talking to their customers all the time. How can your experience be better? How can we do better by you? What do you want? You know, and I think actually saying what do you want is not an effective way to get feedback, but how did you feel welcome when you walked through the door?
Yeah.
How did you feel when you left? What was your favorite part of your class? And being really specific helps trigger the memories of the actual experience for people better than how can we be better? You know, so.
Yeah, we do wrong. Like, I think stuff like that is stupid, but yeah, I agree with what you're saying. Do you transcribe those interviews or those discussions? Like, do you record the call when you call people?
No, because one, because it would be illegal to do without telling somebody that I'm recording them. Yeah. And so that would be a big liability and unethical. And also I don't want to have to say that and then them feel like they're being watched. Yeah. So I'd rather just hear it and then, you know, we can make a note of it in a spreadsheet or on a piece of paper. You know, last Wednesday we had 30 new clients the previous week, and me and Carrie spent less than 20 minutes calling every single one of them.
Yeah. The reason I asked is because whether or not you like record it, and but like if you write it down and then you say like, hey, you told us this on February 1st and it's April 1st and we got it done.
Yeah.
Like, I think something like that, it, like people might even forget what they're telling you, you know, like.
Oh yeah. Oh, you know, that reminds me, I do use another tool that has actually, so it's been a double-edged sword. It's called Frederick, and it's software that sends out like, how would you rate your experience text messages to students right after they take their class. So if the class ended at 9:45, they're gonna get a automated text message at like 9:52. Mm-hmm. And we get a lot of feedback from people that way too. The problem is that the feedback is private, so it doesn't like flow into like a Yelp or a Google. And so once we turned on the Frederick software for our San Francisco studio, we got a lot more feedback, but we also got a lot less Yelp and Google reviews. It's helpful because you get to hear what the detractors, the people who did not have a good experience, are saying. But it's also, you know, has that other side where people are like, well, I already left a review, so I don't need to do a public one.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Second to last question. What is something that every fitness business can do starting tomorrow to save time?
Oh,
yeah. Sounds like you just named a few of them.
Yeah, I mean, Frederick is great. I really do use a lot of software. Mm-hmm. I turned a service called Drift on the front page of our website. So when people log on to www.sfpolandance.com, they'll see the little chat bot for Drift, mm-hmm. and it has my picture on it. So people think they're talking to me, which is great. And then they're more likely to click that button than they are to copy and paste my email address. Anytime you click the link that says email us at info@, it's going to open, if you have a Mac, which I'm assuming most people in the Bay Area do, mm-hmm. it's going to open that Mac email provider that no one uses. Nope. And then you have to copy and paste the email address over to Google. And by that time you're like, you know, forget it. I don't even want to email these people. So mm-hmm. the chatbot, when we put that on, was about a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. We saw a huge uptick in the questions people were answering. Mm-hmm. And then this is the Bay Area. So if your people are in the Bay Area, there, you could throw a rock and hit 10 SEO people. Mm-hmm. You can hit a rock and hit 10, you know, customer analytic people. Mm-hmm. And so from my studio, I have had so many students say, oh, hey, you know, I do customer support automation at my startup. Can I help you with that? Sure, here's $400. Like, please do it for me. And so I, after collecting about 8 months of Drift, which is the chatbot messages, I had one of those students who did customer service automation go through all of the questions and then update our FAQ. so that they were in line with how often those questions were being asked through the chatbot. And we immediately saw, like the next day, we saw the number of chats coming through the chatbot go down by like 50%.
Wow.
Yeah. And you know, what an amazing time savings. I paid $400 to this person to analyze all of our chats. And then she fixed our FAQ. And by the way, people really do read the FAQ if you organize it in a way that makes sense to them. And that's what she did for us. So that was a huge time saver for me. Hiring Red Butler was a big time saver. And then also hiring my general manager at San Francisco was for me kind of a big leap, because I was going from doing everything for myself. Like, I was cutting the hair out of our fans. Like, a pole studio generates a lot of hair. And so I'd be taking the fans apart and cutting the hair out of it. And then I'd be, you know, doing forecasting the next hour and really having people who I trust to help me with all of those things. And also just having a guy for everything. Okay, who's my guy who's my painter? Who's my guy who like troubleshoots when the poles are, you know, like wiggling? Who's my guy for when the air conditioner goes out? Or who's my electricity guy? Like, I have a list of guys, and they're not all dudes, they're women too, but you know what I mean? Like, I have guys on call who I always go back to if they were good the first time, and, you know, with repeated using the same person over and over versus using a handy, I found to be a big time saver too.
Yeah, I mean, I think so many people don't leverage technology because they're afraid of, one, evaluating it, and two, paying for it.
Yeah.
I mean, just like an example from mine, like I use Calendly, and I get appointments every week from people that have just gone to my website and just been like, hey, I want to talk to you.
Yeah.
You know? And it's inbound, and I pay $10 a month for it. It's like, would I pay $10 a month for four more opportunities to talk to people? Yeah, I would.
Okay, so here's my thing with Calendly. Like, do people think that you're pompous if you use it? Like, that's my only hesitation about using that specific service. Are they like, oh, okay, fancy? You know what I mean?
Well, I actually link it on my website to like, Let's Talk.
Oh, I love that.
So the only two ways that, like, if I'm going back and forth with someone who's in another time zone, I'll be like, hey, you're in New Zealand, I'm in San Francisco, let's not like do the mental math and have like a fart and like mess it up. Like, just book it here, you know?
Sorry.
I mean, I don't want to.
That's a nice way of putting it. I definitely worry about that. Like, am I being out of touch? But I like the way that you've said it. Like, I'm going to use that, I think.
I mean, if you just be like, hey, I'm an idiot and I can't figure out time zones, people are like, oh yeah, perfect. Me too. Rather than like, book a time with me.
Yeah, I love that. Okay, I'm stealing that. Thank you.
I recommend it. And also, if I can add a little hack or tip, if people are listening and you are on a membership team and you have like an option to, you know, learn more about the gym, just put a Calendly link in the bottom of the email when your membership like team or when your membership, you know, like program is open, so that people don't have to call you and don't have to email you back and be like, do these three times work? Like, you're going to get so much more traffic from people just booking times than if they have to be like, call me to figure it out. Like, just take the clicks out of it. It makes it so much easier.
100%. I think, you know, a lot of people have been like, why do you use Mindbody? It's so expensive. And my opinion is it's expensive to not use Mindbody. Yeah. It's definitely not the best software out there, but it's the thing that consumers are familiar with.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yes, they take a payment processing fee, but what credit card company doesn't? And so I think there are definitely pole studios in even the Bay Area that don't take credit cards and you can't book online. They'll sit at a front desk and make somebody take cash. I just feel like that would be a lot of time to spend. And then your customers are less likely to come because they're not sure that their appointment is scheduled.
I would say that's dumb.
I would agree.
Okay, last question, Amy. How can people find you and learn more about San Francisco Pole and Dance or Oakland Pole and Dance? Like, how can you be accessible or visible to the average person?
Yeah, so we have www.sfpolanddance.com. If you want to like see what's happening in the studio, we have at SF Poland Dance on Instagram. We have a private Facebook group where we add all like community members, and you know that group is, even though it's private and closed, it's about 400 members strong. And you have people posting like, oh, hey, I'm moving, I have a pole to sell, or hey, who wants, you know, some pleasers for a pleaser order, or, you know, lots of people trading knowledge and information about competitions and how they do their nutrition before training and stuff like that. Cool. Same for Oakland, at Oakland Pole and Dance on Instagram, www.oaklandpoleanddance.com for booking classes. And then I have my own website for, as a traveling pole instructor and artist, which is amybonpoleartist.com. So lots of places.
Awesome. So you can be found.
Yes.
Awesome. All right. Well, we will wrap with that. I want to thank you so much, Amy, for coming on the show. Initially, when I started this podcast, I wouldn't have been like, oh, a pole and dance studio. Like, that's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
But Natalie Carey, who is one of the previous guests, introduced you and I, and I've learned a ton during this like 45 minute conversation. Like, I mean, I learned about like 3 new pieces of software. I think that like, it's just really cool to get people who are in the health industry, but in different kind of little niches, and just figuring out the things that despite maybe like a niche or whatever, they've been able to capitalize on, like what has ultimately made them successful. And I mean, you shared a ton of them. You've been like very open with the numbers and the successes and failures. And I just wanted to say thank you for being open, and thank you for taking the time to come on the show, because like, this is a great episode.
Oh my gosh, it was my pleasure. I'm excited to listen to more episodes of the podcast.
Yay. Hey, when can I try? Am I allowed to try a pole class?
Oh my God, yes, please come. Come to Oakland or San Francisco.
Can I bring my fiance?
Yes, totally.
Okay, cool. That might make me feel better.
You'll love it.
You know, at least so one person in there thinks I'm doing well.
If you have any park where there is something that looks like a pole and you hang out for more than 5 minutes, you will see either a child or an adult. As soon as they touch the pole, their first instinct, it's so natural, is to start swinging around it.
Yeah.
No, we're just monkeys.
I was just going to say, it's probably because we're monkeys.
Yeah.
All right. Awesome. Amy, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
And we'll be chatting soon. All right. Bye.
All righty. That wraps up my episode with Amy Bond, CEO and founder of San Francisco and Oakland Pole and Dance. She is running 2 badass businesses, and I have no doubt that is going to be expanding to cities outside the Bay Area in no time. If you would like to be on the show, or if you are interested in improving the retention at your gym, which I'm guessing you are, shoot me an email at agymotion@gmail.com. That's agymotion@gmail.com. Or hit me up on LinkedIn. I'm always on LinkedIn at least once or twice a day. Easy to find me there. Just search for Alex Armstrong. All right, that is another episode, episode 63. We're chugging along of the Fitness Retention Podcast. I will see you next week. And as always, thanks for listening. Adios.